From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau triggered the start of the national election process in Canada. They do things differently up there. They don't have a set national election date every 3 or 4 or 5 years. The Prime Minister can trigger the process, and it has to be within that 5-year term that the Prime Minister has. Now, Trudeau got elected 4 years ago. He decides now is the time, and we're on. They've already got ads up in Canada. And so the national Canadian election will be held in 6 weeks, October 21st. Can you imagine? Here in the United States, our national campaigns essentially never end. What else would Wolf Blitzer be doing if not for speculating about who's up in the polls this month? What if that one candidate said something bad in high school? Should they be shunned? Can they bounce back? Well, that's not how it works in Canada. Yes, personality comes into play, of course, but the national campaign is over in less than 2 months, and voters tend to focus on party and platform. A leader is elected to put the platform into effect. Let's compare the strengths and weaknesses. Are you envious of Canada? Do you blame Canada? I blame Rob Shum, the Canadian on the panel here, who serves as a professor of public policy at the college at Brockport. You're here to speak for all of Canada. Congratulations. Oh,
well, heavy burden. Thanks, Evan.
Something like 30 million. What's the Canadian population?
Yeah, it's roughly always like California. Think of it like cold California.
Cold California. 30 million people. A little bit more geography. Paul Hippolyte is an American who serves as a political strategist. He's going to school us on a little history this hour. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And Anthony Planzinski-Figueroa is an American who serves as a political consultant and the founder of La Cumbre. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Rob, 6 weeks does sound appealing. I'm going to start there. At the very least, we got to compare time frames here, and Americans may look at Canada and go, whew, that is way, we're on, like, tonight is a Democratic debate. It's like the 19th debate. There's like, they've had 100 candidates. Anybody who gets 0.1% can get on the stage. It's amazing. And up in Canada, you're done in 6 weeks. It's over.
Well, the thing is, the interesting thing is, of course, is that Canada has been moving towards the American system, right? That because before, it used to be that the prime minister could just call an election whenever he or she wanted to. And people had to be, you know, could come at any moment now. But now, over time, there's been this passing of legislation where it's the intention is that the election should always be in October. They should be roughly 4 years apart. You know, there's a limit. They can call it before that or not. So actually, the parties have now been preparing for 4 years. It's not unexpected. Elections in Canada have over time gotten to become more like American elections. So even though there's this 6 weeks sort of period, it's actually not as improvised as is before. And so there's actually this more of this problem of more fundraising, more, you know,
you're
attack ads.
You're killing my Canada buzz here. You are.
But it's interesting. I think it actually is a larger point that the sort of the same problem with Canada is sort of the same problem that you have in the United States, where you have these reform activists, which always say, the slogan is always, the cure for democracy is more democracy. And it actually creates all of these, you know, these unintended consequences and perverse incentives for politicians, right? People in Canada wanted to make things more predictable because they thought, oh, in the past, those prime ministers, they were just timing things, you know, for a short-term advantage, and it was undemocratic, and it didn't favor, again, smaller parties or, again, unheard voices and all of these things. And so the intent was always to make it. They said, oh, look, in America, it's more predictable. Maybe, in that respect, there's something to emulate. And they didn't realize that it would actually turn the elections into a more American-style election. And it's sort of similar in America, I think, the sort of situation where you have where people say that, people say, the party nominating process has to be more democratic. No superdelegates, more primaries, fewer caucuses. And they don't realize in the long run that drives the incentives towards more extremist politicians pandering to the bases and driving this polarization in American politics that you see. People just catch on to this slogan, more democracy is always better, and not thinking about the long-term incentives.
Okay, and so one other question before I turn to our American guests for their perspective on this. But Rob, you've got a CBN up there, right? It's like the CNN of Canada, is that right? CBN? Is it more like the BBC?
There's a couple of big media conglomerates that own everything. You have the similar kind of media concentration.
Do you have the endless talking head punditry?
Oh, absolutely. You have I'm sorry.
It's another export, I feel. So you've imported that as well.
It is not an, you know, it's again this sort of these, you think about the underlying incentives and the underlying problems. In Canada, you have this larger problem where it's a smaller country and you have these two large media conglomerates that control the voices and control the access very, very, very seriously as a problem.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Paul Hippolyte, when it comes to this, at least a system where the campaign in Canada is ostensibly 6 weeks. I'm sure Rob's right. I'm sure there's been a lot of speculation, a lot of planning and campaigning, but it's essentially a six-week process versus our never-ending campaign. What do you like better?
It's different. So in Canada, you have a parliamentary system, so people are more voting for a platform and a party. In the U.S., we have very candidate-centered elections, so the parties are not as important. And so because of that, the voters need time to actually understand who those candidates are and where their positions lie and how they align. So there have been a number of studies done that ask that basic question. Are voters more educated about the issues and the candidates in a shorter or longer elections? And some of the studies tend to show that the voters do know more about our candidates after the year and a half, 2 year long process. And again, it makes sense because the parties are a lot less important in the U.S. style democracy.
Okay, Anthony, what do you make of the main differences there?
The more I'm listening to it, I wonder if the Canadian model is more prone to the October surprise, given the fact that it's 6 weeks. It's that one splash against an opponent that usually happens in elections. As we're talking about, you'd mentioned that it's becoming more Americanized in a way. And I wonder how that gives individuals a chance to lead up to it. I mean, look at all of the dialogue that's happening now about the minutia about candidates right now. I think Kamala Harris is probably suffering some of the worst in terms of sexism and other parts, her prosecution record and things of that nature. So, you know, where does that go in 6 weeks, and can a candidate survive, quote unquote? I mean, they're already going after each other. I think that I saw in the news, just thinking about this conversation, there's already a Trump-like candidate with the jet behind him and he's standing in front of the podium. So people are really mixing it up. And so can 6 weeks be a true time frame for dialogue? I don't know. And I don't know if the American system is the best in terms of now it's become so many years, but I think that the ratings and how we watch TV has really made that develop more, because though voters are complaining about it, they're watching it.
So one of the studies I looked at, one of the metrics they were looking at with the different systems were how people felt about the economy. And that's one of the things that was raised, that within 6 weeks, it's really hard to gauge, like, for the voters to gauge, like, how well they think the economy is doing under one regime versus another. And in that year and a half, 2 year process, people have a pretty good understanding of how they feel the economy is going. And that's one of the number one predictors as to how people or how the swings happen in our country right now.
So listeners, if you want to weigh in on what you prefer, or if you get tired of the endless campaign and horse race, or if you're just curious about Canada, Rob Shum is here to answer all things Canada. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, connections at WXXI.org. He rode in on a moose. He's playing hockey later this afternoon. None of that's true. So here is a comment from a Canadian who asked not to be named in our community, who writes the following. Evan, as for Canadians' view of the American electoral process, the sense I get is we think of it as a soap opera, marked by a long series of hurdles known as the primaries that most Canadians don't really understand. And no Canadian understands your electoral college. That thing is a Frankenstein. End quote. Rob, do you agree with this Canadian's assessment?
Well, I think what's interesting, again, I'm sympathetic to that, but it's also interesting that people who reside in Canada and in Britain, and Paul mentioned this before the show, he met briefly about the changes in Britain as well, which are very interesting. People who have actually moved away from Canada and Britain don't realize how much pressure there has been to actually move the Westminster type systems towards the American model. Britain is even a more extreme situation, where actually, because Tony Blair called a couple of snap elections that generated this backlash that people thought he was being an opportunist, in 2011 they passed a Fixed Term of Parliaments Act, which drastically reduce that kind of power. And you see now they're just still working out how does that interact with all those traditional powers of prorogation or of telling the queen to, you know, that that she should call elections and all that kind
yes,
of process.
Talk about not understanding. this listener may say Canada doesn't get the Electoral College. Americans don't get what you just described pretty much at all.
Right, because as the British call it an unwritten constitution, right? And mm-hmm. so this used to generate this flexibility. And again, it created this sense of not this constant election, but just like once in a while, you know, the people in Parliament decide that they're fed up and want to have an election, but you can't really prepare for it years in advance. That was the driver. But in Britain, again, people thought that that was bad, that that gave too much power to the Prime Minister.
Hmm. So what about the Electoral College, Anthony? I mean, it's interesting to hear that Canadians look at that and think, yeah, we don't get that at all. Do you think Americans get that?
As of the last election, we all say no.
Oh, no. Hey, you're speaking for your political party. By the way, I think there is a pretty good chance that the president loses the next election by 4 million votes and wins the Electoral College again.
I hope not. But, you know, I think that the Electoral College is complicated in that. But what it does do is it does put that focus on those individual states. And so Paul's a bit of a disagreement,
but go ahead.
But what was the talk of the town after the last election? How Wisconsin, how Michigan, mm-hmm. and others were ignored?
Pennsylvania,
how do you ignore those things? I mean, strategists are not, Hillary Clinton supporters are not, right? There was a focus on those individual states. Now, other states, now what do we have now? We have individuals who have now gone to their individual state constitutions and changed their primary elections so that they're first up. And we're going to see what that is this year. We have new rules for debates because it's affecting the primary standings and then, generating towards the Electoral College. So I think there's a lot of complaints in it, but obviously people are working within it to try to make what they want to have happen. You know, how can you get all the votes in the entire, more votes in the entire country and still lose? I think that's the hard thing for people to grapple. But I don't think the people in Nebraska are complaining about that because to them, their votes probably count.
Okay. Paul?
I'm going to quote this or I'm going to attribute this to the wrong founding father. I think it was Jefferson or Madison. One of them wanted that within every generation, the law should expire and we should kind of figure out how to do that again. Great idea, in part because of what we're talking about right now. The Electoral College was a compromise over slavery. It has nothing to do with small state, big state, whatever. It was slavery. We talk about the unwritten constitution in the UK. Well, that's the unwritten language underneath a lot of our constitutional laws. It was slavery. It was how to protect the institution of slavery. And so right now, it's just randomness, the reason why it's Michigan, Ohio. It's not because those states are better representative of the country as a whole. Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Florida, the swing states, it's just random. It's just the fact right now that those are teetering on the brink. And if one of them becomes more red or more blue, then we'll stop focusing on those states. So the states that are swing states could all be big states. They could all be small states. They could be medium of the road states. Florida right now is the third most populous state in the country. Why is that the swing state? Because it's just a product of our environment and where we are now. But there's a good argument to be made. The Electoral College is completely undemocratic. I get it was a compromise from a couple hundred years ago. It has way outlived its course, and it needs to be done away with.
Producer Megan Mack points out that it was Jefferson who said, quote, every constitution and every law naturally expire at the end of 19 years.
There we go.
If it be enforced longer, it is an act of force and not of right, end quote. So there you go. And you like that idea.
I do. Very much.
Logical.
Yes, very much so.
And never attempted.
Because, think about it. Some of the laws we have, just get very local for a second here. Zoning laws. What does that mean today versus 2 decades ago, 3 decades ago?
Yeah.
And it's a lot harder to like, if we were saying, okay, let's start from scratch. This is a new generation. I understand having some basic rights and principles that hold over from one generation to the next. But at the end of the day, I mean, we should be coming up with new ideas and experimenting with our democracy. And we've become very stale and very chained to our ways from decades or sometimes centuries ago.
So, given that we're comparing the United States and Canada this hour, let's talk a little bit about change, and let's talk a little bit about what might actually change versus what is sort of a pipe dream. Because as Rob points out, Canada has been slowly moving a little bit more towards an Americanized way of doing things. Instead of, hey, the prime minister within that five-year term gets to call it whenever they want, there's an expectation built in now that it'll be roughly 4 years, that it'll probably be October, and that anybody who went outside that would be probably viewed as gauche or maybe even illegal. So a lot has changed in Canada, and that has created a bit more of an expected four-year term, the more typical campaign built into that, even if the actual campaign is 6 weeks long. Okay. America has talked, well, I don't know, people like Paul and Anthony and many who work in politics have wondered for a long time if eventually we'll decide that a parliamentary system works better. Our friend Gary Petta beats my ear down every week about this. He's insufferable. Do you like the parliamentary system better?
Well, I think the British are showing us that there's no silver bullet, right? In terms of what they're dealing with in terms of Brexit, all of the kinds of problems that you have, this sort of the incentives for politicians to play brinksmanship games, to push everything, to push the system right to the very edge. Just having a parliamentary system doesn't necessarily solve all of these problems. There are some helpful points to the parliamentary system, as I'm sure other guests have talked about before, in terms of removing this sort of constant gridlock of if you have one party controlling the legislature and one party controlling the executive, that tends to be avoided. But again, it's not a cure-all. One of the reform things that other people point to in the Canadian system that, again, is being eroded in Canada, but outsiders like, is, of course, public financing of elections, right? Within Canada, this is, again, not necessarily thought of as an unalloyed good, that it sort of builds in the existing parties, gives them an advantage, and why should taxpayers pay for the parties to pay for it? But, of course, some American reformers say that that's something to look into to avoid the campaign finance distortions that you have in America. So that's something perhaps, again, some Americans have looked at in terms of possible reform ideas.
Sure. Anthony, do you see us ever moving towards more of a parliamentary system?
No. I think the guessing game of when the election could be run, I couldn't even fathom the idea of Donald Trump having the ability to call the election whenever he wanted. He would probably call it after he just fired Josh Bolton because he thought everybody would think it was a good thing.
John Bolton, sorry.
And it's probably why I don't care too much about his cabinet members. I don't remember their names.
Well, they don't last long.
Exactly.
How many Scaramucci's is that?
So I think the whimsical nature of that, I think the timeline, because people don't want to hear about it all the time, they say that again, but I think the news ratings are high for it, which is why you see Wolf Blitzer all over the news. But I don't think you would head in that direction. I think there's too much. And I think there was an analogy used, and maybe it was off the air, about Canada in terms of population and thinking of it as the cold California. We have a lot more people to get through and a lot more people to see. And so what if people didn't have that access? I think that would be problematic. We're a pretty opinionated country.
So two things. One is I thought you were saying the gold California.
No.
Like a reference to like the gold rush. But also, I'm a big fan of Canada. I'm a really big fan. So I was really happy. So now the cold Canada makes it sound a lot less appealing. But in terms of we're talking about Trump, well, the parliament is the equivalency we would have is the House of Representatives, which is actually controlled by the Democrats. So if there was a snap election.
Right now.
But it's more representative as a whole of the country because of the amount of districts you have. And so I think that in some ways that may be actually a little bit more democratic than you're giving it credit for, because it's closer to the people. And so it'd be a lot harder for someone like a Trump to stay in power in that kind of system than it is in our system, where you're fixed for 4 years. That decision, like, we're stuck with it.
But here's the other part to this, is everything freezes. Dissolution is dissolution. There is no more parliament until another one's elected.
No, not so true.
Well, yes, true, I think. Actually, I believe so. The Senate still exists, but is that the same? Is that the same representation in Canada?
No.
And we should probably turn to the professors who are arguing, but
they have the House of Lords in the UK, and I think in Canada is the Senate.
But it's
different. They don't really have the same amount of power.
They don't have as much power as the American
Senate. In our system, our Senate's more powerful than the House of Reps, where it's flipped in their parliamentary systems.
All right.
It's an interesting point also that Anthony talks about in terms of the access, right, and the fact that you have a larger country, and then you might want to find a system that gets candidates out into more places. But of course, the ironic thing, going back to what Paul was saying about the electoral colleges, is that you actually, again, journalists have been recently counting the number of days that politicians actually spend. They spend all of their time in the swing states, mm-hmm. again, in Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania.
So Which is also just random. Yeah. It has nothing to do with the actual geography or the makeup of the country or demographically. It's just random.
That's right.
And so like one of the – there are a couple of things. So I know one of the things I studied in school was actually multi-member districts. So that's something that we could look into in a system like UK or Canada versus in the US. One of the new organizations that have been springing up all over, they've been pushing for ranked choice voting. So they're playing around with that in Maine right now, I believe, and yep. then there are a number of other municipalities that are looking at that. So there are ways that we can still adjust the system, and we should be looking at ways to experiment.
You know, listeners, I know it's a little dry, but we're going to keep doing shows on ranked choice voting.
No, I'm talking about ranked. I love this.
No, I'm not. I'm just talking about ranked choice voting.
No, I know.
That is a pretty dry subject, but you know what? It's important. Yeah, Paul's going, this is the best, man. 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI here in Rochester, 263-9994. Got a couple of Andrews. I'm going to take an email first from Andrew before I get a phone call from a different Andrew. The email Andrew says, so one of your guests said that in the U.S. we vote mainly for the candidate. In Canada, they vote mainly for the political party and the platform. What are they talking about? I've got friends on both sides of the political aisle in the United States who wouldn't be caught dead voting for any candidate, quote, of the other side. That is how the polarization of our country was built. Paul, let's start with you there. I take that point.
That is accurate. That is accurate. But
we
but
are
also,
pretty polarized by party.
That is accurate. But I guess it also depends on how you're looking at it. So a good example would be in the city of Rochester, we have no elected Republicans. So we're voting based on the candidates in the Democratic primary to decide basically who is going to lead, whether it's mayor, city council, et cetera. And so I guess I understand it in the terms of the general elections, the being a little bit less people staying within their parties. But that's another thing that we have that they don't have in Canada. They don't vote. There's no primary election to determine who becomes the MP or the member of parliament. It's the party that basically chooses the candidate. And if they don't want the candidate, then the candidate is running independent of a party. And so we are still choosing those candidates, and so it's still the parties don't decide for us. We decide in the primaries. And we used to have a system where the parties would put up whoever's going to be the senator from New York or congressperson, whatever, and we changed that 50 years ago. So we don't have – so it is a different system.
Yeah, to Paul's point, it's really about how heavily gerrymandered and sort of self-selected and segregated we are by affiliation, landslide counties, red and blue states, so to speak. And so when you do have one party rule, it really is about the candidate. And the interesting thing is in the Republican primary in 2016, a lot of people thought, well, the party will take control here. It's not going to be about the person. It's not going to be the celebrity, a guy who, you know, has never read a book in his life, but that's the guy who won. So it was about the person, even though he's not really even a Republican, so to speak. I mean, I guess in many modern ways he is, and I'm about to get a deluge of email, and I get that. In many ways, the Republican Party has become who he is. That's
yes.
for sure. That is fair. But
but that's how it works. That's how it has been working in general.
Yeah.
So whoever's the
He's not a reflection of a platform of a party that's been working for decades.
Correct. Or take New York State, for example. The governor basically runs the Democratic Party. And so the Democratic Party's values are basically whatever the governor decides it is because he's the, so, and it would be
down.
The same thing if it was a Republican.
Top down.
So it's candidate driven, not party driven.
Yeah. So, Andrew, I think good points there. And Rob, when it comes to the way the Canadians see it, do the Canadians see this as I'm going to change the question because I'm thinking about Trudeau, and I just read this analysis saying this prime minister election, more than many others, is about the person. It's all about Trudeau, how well-liked he is, whether he's lived up to the values he espoused 4 years ago. Maybe that's true, but a lot of Canadians tell me that we're less obsessed with the candidate, who the person is, what they wrote in their high school. What you know, it's more about what platform, what the party is, and what they're aiming to do. Is
I
that
mean,
fair?
I don't know how you measure that, right?
Okay.
I mean, and I think definitely that, again, there's been a trend, and I think it has to do with, again, more of a media type, you know, celebrity type culture. It seems like every country, every democracy is moving towards more of this kind of candidate-driven kind of politics, that the parties don't function like they used to, that you don't have the mass parties that European political theorists talk about and mobilizing different classes and different class interests. That is all eroded in democracy after democracy. And it's interesting. That's a thing we're grappling with, I think, in political sciences, how to analyze that.
Are we more prone to demagoguery?
I'm not sympathetic. There are people, again, who suggest that, looking at, you know, characters like Huey Long and whatever, and suggesting that in the United States, again, that's part of the presidentialist system, that there's this idea.
I wasn't going as far back as Huey Long.
George Wallace, I don't know, you know, pick and choose. No.
Anthony, party or people?
For the U.S. system? Or
yeah, both.
I actually think it's people. When you get to the brass tacks, How many candidates do you look out there? If you go to their websites, they have Latinos for quote unquote so and so, African Americans for so and so, teachers for so and so. The media sensationalization of this lets us think that there's this Borg looking at it, but the candidates have to get the nuance. If you don't get the nuance, you're going to lose. I think that was the downfall of the Hillary Clinton campaign for president. She didn't get the nuance. She thought that the heavy hammer, the sledgehammer, the bludgeoning of electoral votes and getting those superdelegates in the first part of it and then talking to the big endorsers was going to get it. But the people on the ground didn't move. And so here in the U.S., you have to talk to these affinity groups. You have to speak their language. And if you don't, they're not going to intricately talk to one another and move. So you can call them, you know, some people like to call all of those groups special interests. I think the affinity groups and those issues, you have to speak to the brass tacks of the on the ground issues. If not, you are fighting a warfare of grassroots politics that you're going to lose.
And if it was just about party, Ohio, especially union voters in Ohio, wouldn't have swung in a double digit victory for Trump that mm-hmm. a lot of people wouldn't have thought possible for generations. So a lot has changed. And to Anthony's point, maybe the individuals made certain mistakes or certain judgments in the last election. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just about party. Andrew in Irondequoit on the phone. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, by the way, I don't own a computer, so I'm never the guy that emails you.
We've got lots of Andrews. You're just one of them, my friend.
Yeah. What is the difference between a representative republic and a democracy? Aren't we living in a representative republic in America?
The short answer to that, Rob Shum, is?
Well, the short answer is, of course, we don't live in ancient Greece where we don't all just file into the central square and decide on every single policy. We are all, again, the political scientist Robert Dahl called it a polyarchy, rather, it would be a different term. And there has to be a different way of choosing how representative your representatives are, of course. And it's interesting that, again, this has become a slogan, I know, of course, on social media, this idea that the United States is a republic and not a democracy, and therefore every arrangement that was made 200 years ago by, you know, a bunch of slave owners must be frozen in time forever and for all eternity. Somehow that is what it means to be in a republic, and without regard to objective fairness, it's an interesting way of looking at it. Yeah.
But hasn't our representative republic served us very well? Aren't we a very prosperous and peaceful country?
I don't know if any of the other guests want to weigh in on that.
I think it depends. It depends.
Lots
on
of words.
It depends on who you ask. Again, I think it's the people who are affected. You know, it is those we tend to call them tabletop issues, but those who are prospering and those who are not. And I think this election is going to be a referendum on that of who, how are you better off 4 years now after all the promises, and who's going to answer that question and who's going to bring that change. And so I think that's why there's an affinity and the Democratic side to this idea that Joe Biden can cross over to those more middle class white voters, talk about tabletop issues, but other people are saying he's out of touch. And so I think that when you look at it, it's going to be down to the people and how they feel, and are we better off? I think the folks who are middle class and working class will say no. I think that the business owners and the property owners and all of that, they're like, I love it. You know, this is great. My uncle loves Donald Trump. He's a Republican through and through. But in that aspect, we're not seeing the same return on investment.
Representative Republic or democracy, Paul Hippolyte?
I just have to say this because I've been talking about this the last month, that the ancient Greeks believed that elections is an aristocracy and sortition or lottery is a democracy. So that's a little side note. I can get onto that for an entire hour. I would love to talk about that.
I love this idea. And by the way, if you're going to talk about ancient Greece, I'm going to call you Paul Hippolyte.
Thank you.
So, I mean, I wouldn't have been the first to say it, by the way. Is that a Greek?
No, no. It's a French version of a Greek last name, yes.
French version of a Greek last name.
Yes.
But the ancient Greeks thought a lottery system was true democracy.
Yes. Yes.
So which is anybody so the average, whose name gets drawn is going to go serve for a little while.
Yeah, the average member of the House of Reps is worth $1 million. Do we think that's representative? The average senator is worth about $10 million. Is that representative? Doesn't sound representative to me. Doesn't sound very representative. So I think there are different ways we can do this. But then even, I mean, we're focusing on the federal system. The truth is that we have 50 different forms of government in terms of the states. For example, in California, referendum is used a lot more. In New York, not very much. Mm-hmm. We saw what just happened locally with some electeds trying to push for a referendum. This is not a referendum state. So even how we decide laws locally is very different. And in I believe is it Vermont or is it Massachusetts, where they have hundreds of people that are a part of their their districts are very, very small. And so you have a ton of people that are in their state legislature. So it basically every couple thousand people gets another representative. So it's even in that sense, making the districts a lot smaller makes it a little bit more representative because it's more of the average random person versus when you have these large districts like we have in New York State for our Senate and for Assembly, where you have to have a decent amount of money and name ID and whatever to get elected, where in some of these other states, you just random person farmer decides I'm going to run today and talks to his friends and neighbors and gets elected. So there are different ways to look at it, but a representative republic alone is just a term. It's how we're going to define it and what policies we have in place that really is going to determine what the system looks like.
Everybody ready for a lottery system? City Council, Congress.
Please.
The writer Sam Harris said that he thinks you could randomly draw the name out of a hat of any American and he or she would be honestly a better president than Donald Trump. That's what Sam Harris, the writer, said. He said we honestly should consider doing that. I don't know. There's this idea that professional politicians would serve better. Paul's point, when you look at the net worth, the average net worth of a member of Congress or the Senate, you know, raises the question of how limited that field of opportunity actually is and makes you go all the way back to ancient Greece. I did not know that, by the way, Paul Hippolyte. That's why you're here. Paul's an American who serves as a political strategist. Anthony Planzinski Figueroa serves as a political consultant and founder of La Cumbre. Rob Shum is a Canadian who is here to speak for all 30 million people in Canada. He serves as a professor of public policy at the College of Brockport. And after our only break of the hour, Jim in Rochester will take your phone call. We've got emails from as far west as Vancouver, so we've got more to get through next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, our panel consists of two people who were 18 years old on 9/11 and two people who were just born. Now, those who were just born are 18, finishing high school. Those who were 18 are 36, reviewing what it meant to them and how it changed the way they see the world. The conversation across generations, Friday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, has called for a national election. It's going to happen on October 21st, 6 weeks away. That's it. A national election that's going to be done in less than 2 months. Meanwhile, in the United States, our national election started in January of 2017 and runs about 4 years. That's what it feels like. I mean, it's just sort of a never-ending campaign. Now, the reality, as Rob Shum has pointed out, is that Canada has tightened the rules a little bit, and their national elections are starting to look a little bit more like ours, even though the rules are different. But we're talking about our expectations in a representative republic or democracy or whatever we are, our expectations as voters and how we get exposure to candidates, how we evaluate candidates, how much time we need, what's effective. Here's an email from Vancouver, Dave listening there, who says, as an American and now a Canadian too, who's lived in Canada for almost 24 years, I'd say both systems are terribly flawed. Canada's biggest problem by far is its lack of proportional representation in a multi-party system. Almost never does a government, in the Canadian use of the word, i.e. the majority party in any legislature at any level of government, have anything close to the majority of a vote behind them. That's from Dave. What do you make of that, Rob?
Yes, I mean, the United States actually does have these institutions, both in terms of the presidency and the electoral college, as flawed as it is, and also the Senate, where you have, again, the districts are essentially larger, again, going back to something else that Paul said earlier, so that you don't have this, again, this very sort of hardline original Westminster system where you have this strict first-past-the-post system where people, again, it just happens that most of the votes are essentially thrown away and not counted, because all you need is to get one more vote than your opponent if you're in the winning party, and then you take it all. Yeah.
But I'm also reading that, you know, again, I'm not an expert on Canadian elections at all, but there's going to be some question in the next 6 weeks in Canada. It's not just about Justin Trudeau against the Conservative leadership. There are other parties that are going to sort of jockey for influence and could have an impact on the outcome. And in this country, we're basically a two-party system for the most part, with the exception of Ralph Nader and Jill Stein's impact.
Yes, well, it's interesting that Canada somehow has evolved multiple parties. But again, if we had proportional representation, you'd have a lot more systematically more of these voices going into play. In Canada, you have these problems where, again, potentially before the election really kicked off, there was, again, this sort of strange sort of footsie playing between the more left-wing and the more right-wing party in terms of trying to kick Justin Trudeau's Liberals out, right? Potentially, even though, again, from a policy standpoint and from the position standpoint, that would make no sense. But again, when you have multiple parties, then you have this coalition building dynamic that potentially exists.
Yeah, here's an analysis from journalist David Tribman of the Canadian Election. Quote, "The opposition is not merely Scheer and the Conservatives. Two other parties, the Social Democratic New Democrats and the Environmental Greens, will mount spirited and perhaps consequential campaigns that will siphon votes from the two major parties." Would you be comfortable if we had a system like that, Paul?
No, as I said, ranked choice voting, multi-member candidate elections, those are all, I think, better ways to do this. So a good example is I've a lot of friends and I've worked with the folks with the Working Families Party, and there is a concerted effort to make sure that the candidates align with who they want and they're not just playing spoiler. So that's basically what's happening in a lot of these elections where you have winner take all. So we have, in that sense, I know it's called something different. It's called first past the post in Canada, but in the U.S. it's just winner take all. So it's the same thing where you just need a plurality. You don't need an actual majority in a district in order to win. And so in that sense, if we had multi-member districts, it would better reflect a bit. It would be more representative of the overall views of the populace.
Okay. Anthony?
I attribute this conversation to thinking about what has been coming out in the last few days about the fusion voting in New York State, using New York State as an example. And so I think more participation is good. And as we limit it down to two parties, I think that's the worst part all. But I also think about the New Democrats in Canada and looking at the Greens' effects on the election. And right now, that's what they're looking to have. They're looking to have that splinter. And so when we talk about Canada possibly going more towards an American voting system, not going or just reflecting it a little bit more, I should say, you have some characteristics in that avenue. And so I think I would agree with Paul in terms of the ranked choice voting. And it will be interesting to see how Maine does it and how they continue to do it.
Maine is just one example, but we're starting to see some smaller levels of government attempt this ranked choice voting. We're going to come back to this before the election. We're going to keep coming back to this. I find the whole question really interesting because the notion of winner-take-all can really feel I understand why some people feel frustrated that they get shut out. And, you know, you bring up the Working Families Party. Had a lot of conversations with people like Jesse Lenny over the years who've done a lot of work for WFP. Their view is different, for the most part, than the Greens or Libertarians, who are running candidates separate than Republicans or Democrats, because they feel like our views are fundamentally different. We're going to try to get as big a share of the vote as possible. We're going to try to win if we can. WFP generally tries to put pressure on the Democratic Party from within to move left. And sometimes it's effective and sometimes it's not, which is an interesting... Do you think it's usually effective?
Sometimes. Sometimes. I think it just depends on the year, depends on the candidate, depends on the district. It's all different. But I was going to say earlier, though, that I think the view that we just have two political parties is maybe a little bit too simplistic, because we have coalition parties. I think a large part of the Democratic primary, for example, are going to be slightly more conservative, sometimes black voters, or some Latino voters that may have very specific interests, or LGBTQ groups and interests that. And so it doesn't matter who's running. You're talking about a coalition party, and the views of a Democrat in New York sometimes are slightly different than the views of a Democrat in West Virginia or a Democrat in South Carolina. And so the interests are different. The industries that are important, the ways of living. And so what you said earlier was actually very accurate, where the candidate really has to understand the detail, the minutiae of the detail with the different populations, and speak to them. Otherwise, they will lose votes, and those votes add up over time.
Yeah.
All right. So Jennifer writes to say, as a Canadian, let me just say that I agreed with the earlier comment about the American political system being a soap opera. It's all about tabloid headlines, your ridiculous president, the never-ending campaign. At the very least, we only have to do that for about 6 weeks. Jennifer, from Ontario.
Yeah.
Rob.
That's fair enough, I guess. Yeah, I can just see it from that very specific point of view as somebody who again has to listen to politics and isn't interested. That's definitely an advantage.
But there's no,
and imagine the people
no
in Iowa
opera.
What they have to go through.
There's
right
no
now.
Soap opera with Trudeau and Canadian politics.
Well, definitely. I mean, again, that again goes to my point. Again, is that I think that increasingly, again, you have this same kind of dynamic where politics have become more of a spectator, more of a celebrity-driven kind of enterprise. Again, throughout the industrialized world.
Yeah. Okay.
And the only disagreement I'll have is it's like that if you're a prisoner of the moment and you think that Donald Trump is the norm and that this has been how we've done politics for the last 20 years, I think that's a little bit too simple of a view. I think the election between him and between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney was fairly boring. There were fireworks here and there. I remember Bain Capital and Binders Full of Women. I was just going to say that. But it was mostly boring. And then also, if you think of, and I understand the presidency is a very important and powerful position, as is Congress. But if you think about all the levels of government we have, it's not all tabloid. We just had elections here a couple months ago for school board, for city council, for county legislature. They're fairly boring activities and events. So and those are just as important in some ways as Congress. They do a lot more, and they probably affect you a lot more in your day-to-day life than Congress is going to do.
And I think boredom is underrated, right? There's a
yes
problem.
People think
that there's an issue, right? People think that, oh, well, you know, people should be more excited, rock the vote and all of this. But then you realize that, well, maybe having everybody excited and thinking of it like an American Idol or something like that has its downsides. That, again, just people going down, getting their work done in these kinds of local kinds of elections, that's actually a better way of doing things.
I would argue that, I mean, rock the vote didn't rock the vote. I mean, let's talk about that part. And it did not. And, you know, P. Diddy coming later, you know, vote or die, that did not work either. And I think because, again, you talk about these general themes, you have to talk specifically to what is affecting people individually. Again, getting back to the individuals. I think those who are fighting, using my New York example about fusion voting, those who are fighting to get rid of fusion voting are doing it at their own detriment, because eventually it's still going to go back to the people, their individual issues. And whether they're called Working Families Party members or Green Party members or Conservative Party members, they're going to get groups together. And it goes back to what I think political scientist Richard Fennell called what the representative's home style is going to be. How are they going to reflect and talk to those district members and be active and get their vote? I mean, we call – a lot of folks look at Donald Trump as he is an amusement park attraction. But at the same time, he is talking to the voters he thinks are going to vote for him. And he knows has voted for him and what those issues, the important issues to them are. And he gets them to vote. And so we need to make sure that when we're looking at this, who are going to be those individuals that do that on all sides?
Yeah. So to Jennifer's kind of point about the soap opera and the previous emailer, I get that. And I get Rob's point about boring can be good. Let me also say, I'm not endorsing boring on this program. I'd like to endorse the idea of what we have as an expectation for being excited or entertained. because people aren't going to listen to Connections because they go, you know what? Every noon to two, it's a little boring, but I like it. No, I mean, it's hard, but I think we are coming out of the infancy of the age of 24-hour news, and we've got a real choice to make in media, and it's a real concern. I think there's been real damage done to what do we remember about, you know, Romney Obama, binders full of women, stuff like that. Not the substance. And that's a real problem that comes from that. The heartening thing for me is we believe that if you can put a good program with smart people, strong panels, people who disagree but do it substantively and they don't yell, we can do that in a way that is constructive, that is sometimes healing and interesting, but it goes against all that cable news model. And we've got thousands upon thousands of people who listen to this program every day as a data point against that. So I'm proud of that. But I also think, I just watched this morning this clip from The Newsroom. You remember that show?
Do you remember
the clip that everybody shares where Jeff Daniels says we're not the greatest country? Go watch that clip again, but watch the last 90 seconds where he pauses and then he talks about what could make us a great country again. And it is pretty much crap. I mean, it is, you know, it's this idea that, once we didn't scare so easily and men acted like men and we reached for the stars, but we helped our neighbors and everything.
Didn't age well.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it was this idea that everything was at one point in this country just fine for everybody. But then we went off course. No, I think we are waking up to that it's a lot more complex than that, to the idea that we still have a long way to go to achieve the ideals. And now the question is, what's the best way to get there? What do we expect as voters? So let me bring it back to U.S. Canada. Are we evaluating our possible leaders in ways that are effective? Is there a media role? Is the campaign too long? I mean, if you have a two-year campaign, do you inevitably start looking at sort of tawdry, ridiculous stuff? Or is it more substantive versus a six-week march there? What do you think, Paul?
I think the length is less important to me than what is the substance and what are we talking about. And I think that there has been a push, I think, in the last couple of years to hold the media a little bit more responsible and accountable. I know that there was this backlash to the Democratic Party not paying attention enough to climate. And then they had that CNN town hall debate that I think was 25 hours long, so I did not watch it. But they did. I read some of the Cliff Notes. I read some people talking about it.
7 hours.
Yeah, so I said 25. So there has been a push to have more substantive conversations. And I think that it goes way deeper than that, though. It has to do with all the way back to education in middle school and high school. What is our civic engagement like? Mm-hmm. What are our coursework like? How are we engaging the general public? I mean, and even to the idea of the lottery system, I mean, that would require a very educated and engaged public, which I think is a great thing. That would also, I mean, part of my idea would be a fusion of that kind of system and a more a meritocratic government system. So if you become someone's legislative director, well, you should probably have some experience with a legal background, some experience with legislation, whatever it is. I worked in government. You know what you need to do to work in government and have one of those positions? You need to work on the campaign and be a political hack. Like, you don't need a political science degree to do that stuff. If you're an outreach director, you don't need a degree in the humanities. If you're the chief of staff, you don't need a degree in any kind of managerial experience or whatever it is. And so we have a system now where it's political hacks, getting their hacks elected, and then serving the interests of the folks that are funding them. There has to be a better way to do this.
Anthony,
we're talking in such definites. Who set the schedule? I didn't look at the schedule and find it that the presidential election lasts for 2 years. We're socially constructing this.
Yes. So
we're talking about something that is socially constructed. There is no set schedule. Somebody started doing it, and then somebody said, I'm going to do it earlier because I got to get better than them.
Actually, Jimmy Carter, and I believe 1975, was the reason why we have the whole Iowa nonsense now.
It's just been decades of one-upping each other. Yeah. And so now we went through the whole one of the things I think we should – the whole exploratory mess. Now locally we have it with Senate campaigns. It's just I don't know what to make of it. I mean, but it is truly – we are running 24/7 elections because folks are driven to it. As much as we talked about it not being the case, we're driven to the drama of it. We're driven to the issues of it, and we're watching it. And if folks weren't watching it and folks weren't reacting to it, I don't think it would be there. And so I think that when we talk about the timeline of the election, we have to look at what we are attributing our attention spans to, and we are attributing it to that, to the time. I mean, TV, the last time I checked, was expensive. And so if they're spending 7 hours to talk about one issue and people are watching, and they're going to keep doing that. So I think that change has to come on the ground of what we are giving our attention spans to and what we're not. And I do want to hear more from candidates. I do want to hear more of what is going on. And I would argue that even though the Canadian system now has started the 6-week sprint, that they have been campaigning for the last 4 years. I mean, Trudeau has been a lightning rod of attention since he began. And so I think that it's unfair, you know, back and forth about whether one is longer than the other. They're both long. It's just a matter of how they are, how the environments are reacting to it.
Okay, Rob.
Well, I would just go back to, again, this newsroom clip that you're saying, is that there's this fundamental problem that voters seem to expect angels, politicians, to be angels rather than just people. They don't understand that politicians are responding to the incentives that the voters are giving them and that the system that we've constructed give them. So you shouldn't be surprised if you think it's a problem. It's not just that people are somehow bad, that they're bums that we need to throw out and we need some outsiders to replace them. Any outsiders that you bring in are going to be responding to the same incentives in the whole system, right? And so if you have this problem that systematically rewards either people who are rich enough to be independently funded, as Paul again was mentioning in terms of how rich you have to be to run a campaign nowadays are, or you have to be a person who can find one very wealthy supporter and advance that person's, you know, individual radical ideas, that's the system that's generating these kinds of politics, right? And so you really have to understand that. You don't focus on the personalities. You focus on the incentives in the system itself. And that's what I think people really need to try to focus on.
Canada and the United States, thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Rob Shum, Canadian, who is joining us, a professor at the College of Brockport, and really one of the great guests to kind of elucidate us on a lot of issues. We didn't even mention NAFTA this summer. We always talk about your work on NAFTA. We didn't even talk about that. Anthony Planzinski-Figueroa from La Cumbre and a political consultant, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Paul Hippolyte, a political strategist. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. The second Gilded Age. I want to talk about that sometime.
Want to come back?
Yes.
Let's do that. Josephine, thank you for the great work volunteering. Megan Max, the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.